Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well appointed rec room, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast Toronto affiliate In Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. This morning at about 7 a.m., my twin boys came to my bed, roused me from a deep slumber, and pulled me out of bed. The thermometer had dropped below freezing, and the outdoor rink behind the public school just around the corner from our house was once again frozen perfection. So off we went to play some shinny before I'd even had my morning coffee. I was grumpy. I probably complained the entire 5-minute drive to the rink. In the end, it was 90 minutes of two-on-one hockey, Dad versus two 11-year-olds. Incidentally, at 54, I'm happy to report I still have a few moves, a few deeks and spinoramas left in me. I crushed them, along with any dreams of them playing in the NHL. All right. Truth be told, I lasted about 10 minutes on the rink. I was winded just from bending over to tie my skates. I think they beat me 5-1. Still, it was an idyllic morning, and I hope your day was equally special. If the recent horror in Parkland, Florida can teach us anything, it's not to sweat the small stuff. The unmade beds, the occasional snarky behavior from an 11-year-old who really doesn't want to take a bath, and to really enjoy every moment with our children. As a parent, I've always said I'm in the memory business. I intend to make as many as I possibly can before my two treasures fly off to lead their own lives, or I fly off after mine is done. I know that's squishy and a cliche, but that's all I've got. Well, I'm confident we've cobbled together a quality transmission for you, a little supernatural, a little political subterfuge. If you've ever wondered what goes on behind the scenes at places like Davos, the World Economic Forum, where the muckiest of the mucky mucks gather along with other international celebrities to discuss the state of the world economy, or if you've ever wanted to be a fly in the wall at the globalist humanist gatherings like the Aspen Institute or the United Nations, then I think you'll want to hang in for the last half of Coast tonight this morning and tune in for my conversation with Theodore Roosevelt Malik, who was at one time the odds-on favorite to be President Trump's choice for U.S. ambassador to the European Union. We'll learn why that didn't happen. We'll also get his take on the titanic struggle between globalism and the nation state, the future of the EU, the deep state, the future of capitalism, and much more. In hours one and two, not sure if you remember the Neil Simon play Lost in Yonkers. About a dozen years ago, I was lost in Yonkers. I was looking for tonight's guest, a state-certified psychiatrist. My TV crew and I finally found him, sat down, and had a lengthy conversation about one of his psychiatric patients, who he calls Julia. That conversation remains one of the most chilling and profound conversations I've ever had. It was at once terrifying and faith-affirming. Dr. Richard Gallagher is an Ivy League-educated, board-certified psychiatrist who teaches at Columbia University and New York Medical College. He was part of the team that tried to help this particular patient. Fighting Satan's minions wasn't part of Gallagher's career plan while he was studying medicine at Yale. He knew about biblical accounts of demonic possession, but though they were an ancient culture's attempts to grapple with mental disorders like epilepsy, he proudly calls himself a man of science. Yet today, Gallagher has become something else, the go-to guy for a sprawling network of exorcists in the United States. He says demonic possession is real. He's seen the evidence. Victims suddenly speaking perfect Latin, sacred objects flying off shelves, people displaying hidden knowledge or secrets about people that they could not have possibly known. There was one woman, he says, who was like 90 pounds soaking wet. She threw a Lutheran deacon, who was about 200 pounds, across the room. That's not psychiatry. That's beyond psychiatry. Gallagher calls himself a consultant on demonic possessions, and for the past 25 years, he's helped clergy distinguish between mental illness and what he calls the real thing. He estimates he's seen more cases of possession than any other physician in the world. So, whether we're talking about the globalists hell-bent on destroying the nation-state and enslaving us all, or demonic possession as seen through the eyes of a man of science, it would appear that William Shakespeare was right. Hell is empty, and all the devils are here. Hold on to your hat. This promises to be a bumpy ride. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Why don't you stay a while? Richard Gallagher is a board-certified psychiatrist and a professor of clinical psychiatry at New York Medical College. He is at work on a book about demonic possession. Richard Gallagher wasn't interested in demons when he was at Yale studying medicine. He thought the entire idea was based on an ancient attempt to explain mental illness. But after witnessing victims suddenly speaking perfect Latin, objects flying off shelves, people displaying knowledge they could not possibly have known, Gallagher soon became a believer in demonic possession. Dr. Gallagher, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Hi, good evening. Nice to talk to you again after all these years.
It has been a while. And as I mentioned off the top, that conversation that we had, I guess we chatted for about 2 hours in your office. That has, every moment of that conversation has stayed with me all of these years. When I reflect upon it, I continue to be chilled to the core, quite frankly.
Well, it was a particularly chilling and dramatic case. Thank you for the introduction, Mr. Serrett. I had one slight correction. Julia and nobody I talk about are patients of mine. I was never a patient. I did speak to her on a number of occasions, but I was a pro bono consultant to the clergy, and she knew that. And of course, she knew that if she needed a psychiatrist, which she did not feel she did, I would refer her to somebody else. But none of the people I talk about, and of course, I won't give all the information. If we talk about cases, all the information will be completely accurate, but I obviously won't identify anybody. And to repeat, none of these people I talk about or write about are ever patients of mine.
Thank you for that clarification. But you would have had to have performed some sort of an evaluation as a psychiatrist.
Oh, yeah.
To rule out mental illness, right?
Yeah, I did. I did thorough evaluations. That's what I'm asked to do by both the, I'm going to call these individuals victims, by both the victims themselves and the clergy. I certainly do, you know, thorough evaluations, including medical workups as needed. But again, I don't have a physician-patient relationship with them, and actually they appreciate that.
So let's talk about Julia. Let's get into how she came to you or how you were introduced to her, what you observed, and just sort of take it from there.
At the time, I was working closely with two exorcists. One was a very prominent exorcist who will remain anonymous, but he actually helped found the International Association. And he was the exorcist on this case. And he worked with a guy who, both of these gentlemen became friends of mine. They're both Catholic priests. And he asked me to talk to the woman that I'm calling Julia, again, not a real name, not a patient of mine, because they were kind of frustrated that she wasn't being fully cooperative with the exorcisms. Now, a lot of very experienced exorcists and priests and other scholars for that matter, you know, they know whether the person is possessed or not. I mean, there had been so many dramatic things happening to her that they observed directly that they already knew. Of course, I eventually concurred with it when I got to know her, but they already knew that she was possessed. In this case, this woman who I'm calling Julia, and then I published an article about around 10 years ago. I think, Mr. Sarrett, you interviewed me for that.
Yes.
And she was a Satanist. And again, I'm not a psychiatrist who sees Satanists everywhere. Thankfully, they're probably few and far between. And there was an hysteria about Satanism in this country at that time, and to some extent still. Having said that, there are these few rare satanic cults that exist. I know that very well. And so the priest brought her to see me. It was kind of an odd story because I was in the night before, I was in the bedroom with my wife, and we had two cats, and these cats just went berserk. And I couldn't figure it out. I said to my wife, I said, you know, did they have something bad to eat, or did they find catnip or something? We had never seen them start fighting and clawing each other. And the next morning, the priest, and this was actually somewhat of a surprise to me, and I told him later, excuse me, that I didn't think this was a very wise thing for him to do, although he was a very kind-hearted guy. He actually brought Julia to my house, which was the only time I've had that experience, a possessed woman being brought to my house. And the first words out of Julia's mouth were, nice to meet you, Dr. Gallagher. Well, how did you like those cats last night?
Yeah, I remember that.
Imagine I was pretty taken aback and pretty angry too, that not only that whatever she had to do with it, she kind of smirked about it, but also that the priest had brought her to my house. But subsequently, I had many conversations with her and learned much about her background.
When this priest talked to you about the woman you're calling Julia, as a board certified psychiatrist, were you initially skeptical? Were you thinking, well, he must be wrong, there must be some underlying mental illness?
Well, I'm always a little skeptical. Now, I had been doing these consultations, especially for these two priests, and one of the reasons I had so much experience with these two priests were, at the time, this is about 25 years ago, at the time, they were, you know, one of the few exorcists in America. So, you know, they really saw a tremendous amount of cases, and sometimes I would accompany them or they would bring the case to my office, never to my house before. So at that time I had seen a few cases. So this is not the first possession case I saw. And at the same time, I always, you know, even now, I always keep my skepticism. I remain skeptical of a case until I really see clear evidence. And that's the basic principle under which I operate.
Can you describe her physical state when she came to your house? What did she look like?
Well, again, I'm going to be a little circumspect about revealing too much, but, I can give you some general information that would not in any way identify her. She was approaching middle age. She was not a big woman. She was she tended to dress in dark clothing, somewhat eccentric. She had eyeshadow around to her temples. It was, subsequently, I learned that was part of how the females in the cult kind of paraded themselves. She had very dark jet black hair, which I thought was probably dyed. And at that point, again, even though unequivocally this woman was possessed, and I can go on to give you evidence for that, but unquestionably she was possessed. But, you know, when a person is possessed, they come in and out of these states. It's not like 24 hours a day, except in very rare cases, which also exist. It's always hard to generalize, but except in very rare cases, these people will come in and out of these states of possession. So when she was talking to me, she was You know, pleasant enough. I felt she had a kind of sarcastic side to her. But, you know, she basically always treated me respectfully. She knew I was, you know, just trying to be of help to her.
And you witnessed her in the state of what we would call possession, when she wasn't obviously herself, when another voice was coming through?
Well, a few days later, the priest and I and Julia, we took a ride. He was, I think, ostensibly, he was looking for a church institution where he was going to continue the exorcism. The exorcisms had already begun. She had about seven or eight in all. And Julia was sitting in the back seat of the car, and all of a sudden, a voice comes out of her. Now, again, these demonic voices, and I have no doubt this was a voice of a demon, these demonic voices use the vocal cords of the person. So it mildly sounded like her, but it was much more raspy and much more angry and very, very demeaning, and it would say things like, I won't quote all of it directly because some of it was curse words and scatological language, but it was something to the effect like this, and I'm not going to try to imitate it, but it was something to the effect like this. You know, I said, leave her alone, you effing priest, you monkey. She's ours. Leave her alone. And that's a fair summation of the sentiments that that she expressed. I always thought it was interesting that she called him a monkey, which is, I suppose, what the demonic world thinks of human beings.
Did she ever try to physically attack you?
No. No, she didn't. Now, during the exorcisms, and I've been to many exorcisms, Mr. Serrett, in my life, you know, several hundred.
Several hundred?
Yeah. But I didn't go to any of hers. Again, you know, I had a family to bring up. I had a very busy, you know, career as a doctor. And, you know, I just couldn't go to her exorcisms, you know. But she certainly, in the full possessed state where the victim is in a trance, and at that point she doesn't remember any of it. For instance, in the car, she came out of this, I'll call it a trance, I guess that's the best word, and she said to us, where are we? We seem to be in a different place. And I asked her if she had remembered what she had just said, and she said, what do you mean? She had no recollection of this voice coming out of her. And again, you know, there are all kinds of psychiatric theories that people can trot out, like this was a dissociative state, et cetera, et cetera. But you always have to take the total context. And both in the exorcisms and in other situations, it was clear that she had classic signs of possession. She knew all kinds of hidden arcane things. For instance, she knew how my mother died. She knew how many people's parents had died.
Things that there is no way, there is no plausible explanation for how she would have known these things, correct?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, but she did that all the time with multiple people, and she did that with other pieces of knowledge too. It wasn't just, you know, how somebody's relative had died. It was, for instance, she claimed the paranormal ability. You know, we use the term paranormal, which is a slightly quasi-scientific term, in my opinion, to explain things that past ages would have said was simply supernatural or preternatural or demonic, spiritual in some way. But, for instance, she could tell at a distance what the exorcist was doing. This is a I'm going to call it preternatural. Most people would call it a paranormal ability to see people at a distance called remote viewing.
Yes, Dr. Gallagher, if I could just jump in here. We're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, I'll get you to tell us in more detail what you're referring to as we discuss the demonic possession of Julia. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Toronto. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. It would seem that 2018 is turning out to be the year of the time traveler, as more purported people from the future have stepped forward. Most recently making waves is a future man who, unlike other individuals who have made similar claims, appears to be showing his face, although it may be distorted by some kind of mask or makeup. And you can check out the video where our webmaster tonight, Sean Latisore, has posted it in the slide carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with Dr. Richard Gallagher. He'll let us in on the remote viewing skills of the demonically possessed right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Dr. Richard Gallagher is with us. He's an Ivy League educated board certified psychiatrist who teaches at Columbia University and New York Medical College. And he is the go-to guy for a sprawling network of exorcists in the United States. We're talking about Julia, not her real name, and she possessed remote viewing skills, I guess is how we would put it. I remember us discussing this particular episode where you were actually on the phone with this exorcist. He was in another location, and I will let you sort of take it from there, because this is one of those stories that just, again, the hackles on my neck as I talk about it and remember it now are standing up.
This Mr. Serrett, was the other exorcist, whom I'm calling the assistant exorcist. This woman had two exorcists really involved with her. During the remote viewing episode, she claimed that she could see him from a distance. And I said, you know, give me a break, Julia. Describe him, and then she described his clothing, khakis, windbreaker, walking along the beach. So I said, well, I'm going to call him up. So I called him up, and he verified that that's exactly what he was doing. I think the incident you're referring to was I was on a regular telephone with a landline with the assistant exorcist, and he was telling me about an upcoming exorcism that they were scheduling. He was hoping that I could make the exorcism as an observer, which is what I would be doing. And it's often good to have, you know, a sort of medical person there if possible. And I said that I couldn't come. And in the middle of my conversation with this priest exorcist, we knew that Julia was, you know, about 1,000 miles away. But that voice that I had heard from the back of the car, you know, very much similar, with similar sentiments, saying, you know, leave her alone. She's ours. You know, you'll never get her. You know, basically sort of bug off, you effing priest again. And so I said to the priest, since this voice had come in over the phone conversation, I said, did you hear that? And he said, you know, yes, Rich, you know, in these very, very dramatic cases, this sort of thing can happen. And of course, you know, Julia had no awareness of that and was 800 miles away. She was not on the phone or anything. So what made her case and why I wanted to write about it, which I did, and I also have done in much more depth in my upcoming book, Demonic Foes, which, if you don't mind me saying so, will be published probably in the summer by HarperCollins, Harper One. And I give the full story of Julia, her background, and, you know, all that happened to her, and describe the exorcisms in depth, which, again, I got reports from multiple people about.
If I could just jump in here for a second,
Sure.
Richard, when this discarnate voice interrupted your phone call with the assistant exorcist, and again, you're surmising she was some thousand miles away, can you
Well, I
remember?
knew exactly where she was because I had spoken to her on the phone. She was at her home, which was about 1,000 miles away.
Can you take yourself back and remember your feeling as you heard this voice come over the phone?
Well, I would say at this point in my investigations, let's call it. I mean, I'm pretty used to this stuff, but at that point, that was a new experience for me. And yeah, sure, the hairs on the back of my neck went up a little, I mean, it was spooky, and I was a little mystified too, and that's why at the time I said to the priest, "Did you hear that? I want to make sure he was hearing it." And he somewhat in a blasé manner said, "Yeah, this happens, Rich. Welcome to my world." I just want to say that this is a woman who had amazing psychic abilities, and even outside of her being in possessed state. And the reason that that was the case, we always believed, was because she was a high priestess in a satanic cult. I mean, what is pretty amazing, and of course she only did this really because she wanted the help of the church at that point to resolve her possession. She knew she was possessed and she was asking to be delivered. The only reason that she told me all of this was because she was seeking our help. But it was kind of amazing that a very prominent Satanist with very prominent psychic abilities, as some of them have, revealed herself so openly to me. And also, as I think I told you years ago, Mr. Serrett, gave me permission to talk about her. So this
You
was a
said that
very
she...
explicit permission for her to tell her story. I think she wanted, in a way, for the story to be propagated.
At a certain point, I'm not sure it's whether it was when she first came to see you or when she was brought to you, she had already undergone seven or eight exorcisms. Why didn't they
Well,
take?
a few. She had about seven altogether, a
Okay.
couple after I had seen her.
Why didn't they take?
Because she never really fully cooperated. She never left the cult. And I think she was terrified of leaving the cult. She was afraid that she was going to be punished by the cult. And the cult had brutal means of punishing people. Now, she may have been ambivalent. She told me once she didn't understand God. The Satan she knew and Satan she felt had given her powers, which she was very proud of. And so she certainly got a certain amount out of being in the cult. Including the sex she once told me. And I think she was just highly, highly ambivalent. But, people can think of exorcism as a magic incantation. It's not a magic incantation. Exorcisms help, they help a lot. They help keep the demons quiet and at bay. But the person has to work on it, the person has to have a kind of deeper conversion. Person has to turn to God. Again, it's not magic. They're not automatically going to be delivered by, magical prayers. But they have to work at it as well. So the exorcism is important, but their own process of turning away from evil, in her case, turning away from Satanism, is critical. And she was unwilling to do that. That's why she wasn't delivered.
Although you didn't attend any of the exorcisms involving Julia, the attending priests and other members of the clergy that assisted in these exorcisms, did they relate to you what they witnessed? For example, was there a levitation? Was there a speaking in foreign language, etc.?
It was all of that. This was an amazingly dramatic case. And again, I'm not just talking about one person giving me a report, although I certainly got most of the reports from the two priests I'm talking about. But there were other people. There were two nuns. There was a nurse. There were some lay people who attended these exorcisms. And all of these people verified all the details of the exorcisms, which included her speaking in foreign languages, Latin, for instance, which she never knew, and all kinds of actually fairly wild things that went on during the exorcisms, the room getting cold, that sort of thing, and also her levitating for about a half an hour. Now, levitation is rare. It's a rare thing. It's been reported in some other context, but leaving aside that, you know, I've talked to a number of priests during the course of my life, including a professor in Austria, who tell me that during their exorcisms, also the person has levitated. So this is this happens. It's rare. Possession itself is rare. Levitation is extremely rare. But look, I tell people, I just report what either I see or what multiple credible people tell me. And you don't have to believe me. You can just buy a good book by an exorcist. A good friend of mine, Gary Thomas, in California. Father Amorth, who used to be president of the association. Father Bamante, who's the present president of the International Association, very capable guy. I mean, these people all write about the same things that I'm telling you about. Why I decided originally to write about Julia was it just, as a possessed high priestess, she called herself the queen of the cult, was very devoted to Satan for many years. Was, I think, very afraid of leaving Satan and the cult. She just was such a dramatic case that I felt that it should be written about. And,
in the
and
end,
remember the priest I'm referring to, the one that Julia saw in this remote viewing episode and described to me, and whom she said the cult particularly hated, because he did help found the International Association, was a very holy, effective exorcist. That priest also talked to you, if you remember.
Yes, how could I forget that?
He verified everything I say.
He did. You had arranged for him to call me, which he did, late one evening. I was alone in the house. I took the call, recorded it.
Yeah.
And before we began discussing this case, he told me that it was important for him to pray over me, which he did.
Right.
I remember distinctly never having felt so cold in my life, or more frightened.
Yeah.
And now, do you is this when you talk about this sort of thing, as we're talking now? As the priest and I were talking about it, does that open us up for some kind of oppression, possession?
Well, I don't want to be melodramatic about it. I do think that if you're heavily involved in this type of field, you should be careful yourself spiritually. And, you know, I, for instance, have many people praying for me. I actually would probably not do this work, which again I do for the most part pro bono. I would not do this work if I didn't feel that I was covering some spiritual bases.
What happened to Julia in the end?
Well, she dropped out. She dropped out of pursuing exorcisms. She was scared. And, you know, again, I had many conversations with her. She told me she was scared. She was scared of the cult. She may have been a little bit playing a double game, you know, wanting to be relieved of the possession, which she certainly did, but not fully prepared to really reform her life or turn from evil. And then we heard about her about a year after her last exorcism. And the priest, the assistant exorcist, wanted me to talk to her because he wanted me to make sure that she was healthy enough to resume an exorcism, because she had called him and was asking to resume the exorcism. And I spoke to her and I said, you know, why have you decided to resume the exorcism? She said, well, I don't want to be possessed before I die. And I said, so you're dying? And she said, yes, I was diagnosed with cancer. And I said, well, I'd have to speak to your oncologist. And she said, well, I have to think about that. But I am dying. And then we never heard from her again. So I presume that around that time she died.
Right. When you decided to write about this, and it was in the New Oxford Review, which is a
Catholic...
Yeah,
it was in a religious periodical.
Catholic magazine.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that the first time you had written publicly about this?
About this particular case, yeah.
Or about any case?
It may have been. It may have been, yeah. I mean, I'm sure, I'd spoken to people about it, and... people sometimes, you know, have me give talks and that sort of thing. So I know that I had probably mentioned her and mentioned my work, but that was probably the first of, you know, several publications I have.
And your decision to write about it and to write about this case as, again, someone who graduated from Yale Medical School, someone who is a Ivy League educated, board certified psychiatrist. Did you have to think long and hard about doing that? Because I'm sure your colleagues must be calling you a heretic at this point.
Well, it's a funny thing. First of all, organized psychiatry is pretty agnostic officially about this stuff. In other words, they don't really take a position because they regard it as a religious issue. Number two, there are quite a few psychiatrists who do believe in this stuff. They may be a little less experienced than I, or they may be more unwilling to speak out, but a few of them, for instance, my chairman at the time was a very prominent psychiatrist, past president of the American Psychiatric Association, and he encouraged me to investigate this whole field. In fact, he wrote an endorsement of my upcoming book, Demonic Foes, and gave me a very, favorable review. So it depends, I think the field is a little bit past the unthinking anti-religious bias of, say, the old Freudian crew, even though I'm a psychoanalyst myself. Having said that, there's a wide spectrum of opinion. It's a pretty tolerant country we live in, including physicians. And at the same time, look, it's a big country, and there are many Christian, Catholic, and other religious Muslims, for instance, psychiatrists who have openly told me that they applaud what I'm doing and, believe me. So it's a complicated world out there. You know that.
But I have to say, I'm shocked that the psychiatric field, as you say, would exhibit such tolerance with regards to this issue. It's certainly not reflected in the mainstream media, that tolerance. The orthodoxy would be that exorcism is a throwback to the Dark Ages, that it's dangerous. They will highlight the cases where young people have died during the performance of an exorcism and so forth, and this is the way that it is portrayed in the mainstream media. Would you not agree?
Mostly, but not entirely, and rightly, the misuse of exorcism or the misdiagnosis of people who are mentally ill as demonically attacked or something. These are real things too. One of the reasons I wrote my book was not only to alert the educated reader about the facts, the real facts of a number of these cases, especially Julia, but also to warn people who suffer from mental illness and only imagine that they're attacked by demons, that has to be watched too.
Absolutely. Listen, let's take another time out, come back. We'll talk about some other cases. Dr. Richard Gallagher stays with us as we continue to discuss real cases of demonic possession.